Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Inside Edition. I'm your host, John Robb. We want to thank you all, however, wherever, and whenever you are listening to the show. We want to thank you for making Suspense Radio a part of your entertainment world, talking to some fabulous authors today. 90-minute show, three fantastic authors. We're going to kick it off with author Jane Diskin, followed by Alan Eskins, and then Mark Pryor. So a very exciting show. All three authors have a very unique kind of approach to their writing and their books. You're going to hear them all coming up, and we're going to jump right in, and we are going to hit it with our first guest. He is, again, author James Diskin. His book is called Stone Cold Dead. It is the third in his Ellie Stone mystery series. So we want to welcome Jim to the show. So, Jim, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm great, John. Thank you.
So, like I just said, Stone Cold Dead is your latest book. It's the third in your Ellie Stone mystery series. Let's just jump right into it. Why don't you go ahead and tell everybody a little bit about the book, or if you want to, kind of go back to the beginning and talk about the series, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, I guess I would just jump in and talk about Stone Cold Dead. The series takes place primarily in an upstate New York town, a small dying town in 1960. And when I say dying, I mean economically. It's one of the former mill towns of upstate New York. And a lot of the industries have packed up and moved south in the 50s, kind of leaving behind a dying town. It's a town whose best days are behind it. Now, Ellie Stone is she's a New York City girl who has this small backwater, provincial backwater in upstate New York, because she wants to be a journalist. She wants to be a reporter. She comes from a very cultured and, intellectual family in New York City. Her father is a very famous professor of literature. Her mother is an art dealer. She wants a job that doesn't involve picking coffee, that doesn't involved taking shorthand. So as things turn out, she manages to find a job at a small daily in upstate New York. So in Stone Cold Dead, as you mentioned, it's the third installment in the series. Ellie has made a little bit of a name for herself in the second book, No Stone Unturned, by writing a lot of very high profile stories about the murder of a local society girl. So in Stone Cold Dead, when a 15-year-old girl from the wrong side of the tracks disappears just before Christmas, and the police are loath to help her mother find her, insisting that the girl probably just ran off with someone and will come back when she's good and ready, the mother is desperate, and so she calls on Ellie on New Year's Eve in her home to ask for her help, because she has read her articles in the newspaper about the high-profile murder that had taken place shortly after Thanksgiving, just a month and a half, or a month, 5 weeks earlier. So So the backdrop is a frigid cold snap in the town of New Holland, which is the small town, fictional town in upstate New York. And that's where the title is coming from, Stone Cold Dead. It's just a brutal cold snap. And that's the background or the backdrop for this story, which opens on New Year's Eve as Ellie receives a late-night visitor asking her for help in finding a 15-year-old girl who has disappeared.
Yeah, it's kind of course, parents' nightmare. And you know, when you're reading the synopsis or of the book and you just see the part where it says, you know, Darlene Hicks slips away from school, the bus is sitting there waiting to depart, it rumbles away, and she's never seen again. I mean, that right there just kind of, as a parent of four, you know, it kind of makes your heart jump, makes you be like, oh my gosh, you know, something's going on, and the suspense. And you would say this is definitely more of a suspense book. It's a building to the climax. It's not a thriller where it's just, you know, running fast-paced through. You know, this is a suspense. This is a building of everything that's...
Absolutely. I think you hit it on the head. It's not what will happen next, although there is an element of that, obviously. You know, it's not just a static thing, but it really is what happened. The question really is what happened, not what will happen next, which I think makes it, you know, a mystery or a whodunit or more of a suspense novel than a thriller. You know, the thriller is really about, you know, that breakneck pace about, you know, what's going to happen next to the hero or the heroine.
Yeah, it's like I always say, thrillers are, you are running up a mountain, shit is blowing up all over next to you, you're trying to get away, and when you get to the end, you just jump off the cliff. That's what I always consider
exactly.
A thriller, because it's just fast-paced, nonstop, keeps going. A suspense, you know, you're walking up the same mountain, and it's a building process, you know, you're kind of, you know, something might jump out over here, or you might find something out over here, but you're building up to the end, and when you get to the top, then everything kind of unfolds in front of you. You kind of see what it all is about. And those are, I always find, you know, extremely entertaining to myself because I like the build-up. I like to see, you know, the clues that the author's kind of left throughout the book and how everything kind of works itself together, kind of like a spider with all the legs, and then they all kind of weave a web at the end, and it gets together. And my question is, when you're writing a book like this or you're getting involved in like a series, you have a lot of little tangents that are coming in. So how are you, do you kind of write organically? Do you kind of write an outline to keep everything straight? How do you do it?
Yeah, I start with an outline. I know where the book is going and where it's ending. And it's, I won't say it's the most detailed outline you've ever seen, but it definitely, you know, covers many certainly a lot of important scenes. But that said, as you know, once you start writing, you do come up with better ideas along the way, or at least, you know, details that flesh it out more, that maybe an extra scene or two that really make it, you know, sing a little bit more. So the outline is not etched in stone, although, which would, by the way, make another great title for an Ellie Stone book, but the outline, you know, I know where it's finishing, and then along the way I might take a few different turns, but I find the outline helps a lot. You know, many of my, you know, writer friends have, you know, they talk about this a lot, and especially even at writers' conferences, and the, it must be 90% of the people say that they are pantsers, that they write by the seat of their pants, that they do not outline. The only small minority seem to, and while I do take a lot of, you know, unexpected detours along the way, they all still remain within that general outline. And again, the ending doesn't change. I mean, I don't get to the end and say, oh, I think this person should be the murderer, because everything I've built along the way, as you were mentioning, you know, you find, you lay the clues that you want, and hopefully it ties together, you know, perfectly at the end. And you know, you don't have any stray, you know, any loose ends or any, you know, things to tie up, and you've dealt with all of your red herrings, and they make sense, and they're not just there for, you know, gratuitous reasons, but are legitimate, maybe false leads. So I do follow that, you know, that outline. At least the destination is remains the same. But along the way, I might take a few detours. And I always say, you know, it's a shame, because the longer I have to write a book, I really believe, you know, the more better ideas I will come upon along the way. So it's always, you know, you finish and then 6 months later you say, oh, I wish I had thought of this detail at that time. It would have helped a lot, or it would have, you know, made things more interesting, or just, you know, fleshed everything out and made it a little richer, you know. So that's how I work.
Yeah.
And every author always has, that's the one thing I try to tell new authors, because every author has their own style. You never want to try to mimic another successful author's style, because then you kind of lose your own way. You have to find the way that works for you. Like when I write, I mean, there's a lot of times I'll just throw a bunch of crap out there and just throw it out, let it go, and just keep going and going. And then all of a sudden I start thinking and going, okay, this isn't going to work, so now I have to go back and write myself out of that problem and then change it as I go forward and kind of move things that way. But it doesn't work that way for everybody. Everybody has their own unique way of writing. So when you develop your style, is this something that you developed over time from, like, the first books to, like, now? Or is this kind of how you've always had your writing style?
No, I think that earlier on, and I've written a few books that were never published and shouldn't be published, of course. They just weren't very good. I think I was much more of a just vomit it out on the page and we'll clean it up later, which can work. And I think if you can, I do that on a smaller scale, you know, maybe chapter to chapter, there are these bursts of, these bursts of creativity and imagination that you hadn't counted on or you hadn't thought of before. It's when you sit down in front of the computer and you're actually, you know, you immerse yourself in the story that day that it's remarkable how many new ideas pop up. And so I used to write more, I think, by the seat of my pants, and now it's a little bit more controlled. But, you know, it is important to, as you mentioned, you know, come up with, you know, formulate your own style and not be derivative of others. And I like to think that I'm not, but, you know, maybe there are writers that write in a way that's similar to my writing, but not something that I would do consciously, that's for sure. I try to make my own voice. And also, in terms of the way I write, I do a lot of editing as I go. So I'm not saying that the result is pristine every day, but it's pretty clean at the end of each day, and then at the beginning of the next day, I might reread. I will reread what I wrote the day before and kind of clean up the language. I'm always looking to make sure the words are the right words. They're the words, even if it's a simple word, it doesn't need to be some fancy word. But am I saying it, you know, am I writing what I mean and not just, you know, something that approximates, you know, the meaning that I'm searching for.
Gotcha. And I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking with author James Ziskin, and you want to go to his website. It's James W. Ziskin, that's ZISKIN.com, for more information. And when you click on So Cold Dead, the one thing you're going to find out is right now until May 11th, you have a Goodreads book giveaway. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we're giving away 5 copies on Goodreads. Anybody can enter. It's open only to the USA because, for, you know, in other words, for shipment within the United States. But that's only because it's quite frankly just it's very expensive and complicated to ship it overseas. You know, you have to fill out all kinds of forms. And but anyway, you just you can look at on Goodreads. You can look up my name, James W. Ziskin. Or you can look up the title and you'll find it. And then it very prominently displayed, it says, you know, there's a giveaway. 5 copies are being given away. I think it expires, the contest ends on the 11th of May. Now, Goodreads selects the winners. I have nothing to do with it. And my publisher has nothing to do with it. It's just they pick them at random and then they let us know who it is, and then we ship the books to the winners in a very timely fashion. So I encourage people to enter. It's you've got nothing to lose, and you can only win if you enter.
Exactly. Yeah, you can't win if you don't enter, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, now, so let's start going back now a little bit for people that are just finding out about, and they're going, oh, he's already in book 3. What the heck happened in books 1 and 2? So do you want to go back to the first book, which is Sticks and Stone, and then you have No Stone Unturned, which is number three. So we have a theme going on here, of course, with the stone in there, of course, but that's to be expected with your character, Ellie Stone. So why don't you go back to Thick and Stone and go through the second book and kind of how things have Stone Cold Dead, which is now.
Sure. So Sticks and Stone is set, it opens in January of 1960. Ellie Stone is, as I mentioned before, a young woman who wants to make her own way in the world of journalism. Maybe journalism is overstating it. I mean, she wants a job as a reporter. She studied journalism at Columbia or at Barnard. And so that's the thing she wants to accomplish in life. She's not trying to blaze trails for women. This is pre-feminism. This is, pre-women's movement. This is very early on in 1960, a very conservative time. But she's a very smart and cultured young woman. So she comes from a family I mentioned before that her father is a very, very prominent professor of literature, in fact, of Dante. He's a Dante scholar at Columbia University. And the book opens with her in this small provincial backwater of New Holland, New York, where she has found a job, and she's been for a year or two, with news that she receives news that her father has been attacked in his apartment in New York, and he is at St. Vincent's Hospital in critical condition with a having been hit on the head and robbed in his apartment. So she returns to New York, and it's a difficult journey for her because she and her father are both very headstrong and opinionated and difficult people at times, especially her father. And so she is estranged from her father. To complicate mm-hmm. matters, her mother had died a couple of years earlier from cancer, and she had a very dear older brother who had been killed shortly before the mother died in a motorcycle accident. So it's really just the father and the daughter who are left, and they don't trust each other. They don't really get along. There's a lot of drama between them, and now he's lying in a coma in a hospital in New York, and she has to go to his side and deal with those emotions. At the same time, when she arrives, she feels something's a little bit fishy. So she is drawn into the investigation as to what happened. She's not entirely convinced it was just a random robbery in his apartment, burglary in his apartment. And her suspicions are confirmed a day or two later when she discovers that another professor in the same department was electrocuted in his back. So there's really something kind of strange and fishy going on. So she gets drawn into the investigation. She works. I mean, she has access to the police because her father has been attacked, so she's the daughter of a victim, and so, they are indulgent, if you will. It's 1960. It's not quite, the same crimes aren't investigated in the same way as they might be today. They probably would not let her be as involved. But also, she does forge, she has a habit of forging very tight relationships with police. She likes policemen, and they tend to like her. She does describe herself as a modern girl in 1960. Many people have compared her favorably to Peggy Olson on Mad Men. She's a bit of that type. So she's not an old-fashioned girl. She's and I use the word girl using the parlance of the times. But that's the story of Sticks and Stone. It's this investigation. It's a bit of an academic angle to it because it's set in an Italian literature department at Columbia University, most of it. And the second book takes us back upstate where Ellie is toiling away at this small daily. Really, it's just one or two notches above secretary at this newspaper, but she does get to report on stories if she hustles. But she's really becoming quite frustrated and feeling it's not going anywhere. Her father has always told her that she's wasting her time with this little tiny newspaper, in this place where they don't appreciate what the work she does, et cetera, et cetera. But it's shortly after Thanksgiving, 1960, and she hears a dispatch on the police scanner about a body having been found in the woods north of town. And so she's the first reporter on the scene. She also is a photographer for the newspaper. She does a little bit of photography for them. Since the police photographer is out of town, and remember, now we're in a very small town where things are not done by the book necessarily, at least not in 1960. So the sheriff asks, okay, Ellie, can you help us and take pictures of the body for us because we need pictures? So she gets right in on the ground for this investigation. And the victim, as it turns out, is the daughter, the beautiful, brilliant daughter of a local judge. Actually, he's a state appellate court judge, but he is local. He comes from New Holland. And he is the scion of the family that built, really, the town of New Holland, that built the carpet mills that made the town great once upon a time. And then his family later abandoned the town and took all of the carpet mills down south where labor was cheap and non-union. But he decided to stay. He decided to stay with the town, and so he is still there. So this promising life is snuffed out, discovered buried, half buried in the woods north of town, and Ellie's investigation takes off very quickly, and she makes some quick progress in finding that the young woman who is a senior at Tufts College in Boston had spent part of the Friday after Thanksgiving, had spent that night at the Mohawk Motel, which is a local trysting spot and quite a seedy locale. So the story starts to get interesting from there. She discovers that there were some strange visitors to the girl's room before she died. Mm-hmm. And so what you have in No Stone Unturned is really one of those creepy small town murders that everybody knows everyone else in the town. She's also a
right.
well known person. And in 1960, proper young ladies didn't meet men in motels. They might have done it, but they certainly didn't want it to get out. And unfortunately, here it does get out. And then you've got local suspects from Boston where she was at school, boyfriends. There's a peeping Tom at the motel who plays a big part and becomes quite important in the plot. So it's one of those, those small town murders where everything seems, all of the secrets of the town can be laid bare, and it's even more disturbing in many ways than a big city murder because you have that veneer of propriety and everyone thinks that this is such a nice place and nice people, and then something like this happens and just tears that to shreds. So that's really how No Stone Unturned plays out. It's a local small town murder as opposed to the first book, which is a big city murder down in New York.
Yeah, and see, there's those small town feel books that you really get involved with the characters, you really start getting involved, because one of my favorite shows, and everybody of course on this show knows, I'm a Murder, She Wrote fan. I love it because, things were Cabot Cove. It was very nice. Small town, peaceful. Nothing really happens. But when something does happen, it's a huge thing. I mean, if a murder happens in Los Angeles, it's just like, yeah, next channel. But if a murder happens in a very small town, everybody wants to know. Everybody's involved. Everybody has to get their hands into it. And that always makes for interesting reading. And so that, real quick, because we're kind of running out of time, what's the most difficult part of writing a series like that for you?
Well, I don't know. It is difficult. What I find difficult is trying not to make it Murder Capital USA because it is a little town, And I know we can suspend disbelief and we want to make sure that, people can believe that there's a murder. So I've got two murders after three books in this little town. Book four is going to take it up into the Adirondacks a little bit. Maybe 50 miles north, just there's a different murder, just to try to fix that. But that's one of the things I do worry about. What I love about the small town, and I like the comparison to Cabot Cove, even though these books, the Ellie Stone books, are not cozies in any way. They're not
right.
noir either. I think they're really a traditional kind of crossed with a little bit of noirish elements. But what I love about the small town, which you do get in Cabot Cove, and you also get in I think my books, is that secondary cast of characters that come back. And you see them, the sheriff, who becomes really a protector of Ellie and after a rough start. I mean, they work very well together, and he likes her, and he looks at her, he's kind of a father figure to her. There's the local ice cream shop across the street, and the owner is in love with her, and, you know, and he's her Watson, he's Watson to her Holmes. So, and the district attorney, and the, you know, her boss at the paper. There are just a lot of local characters that are a lot of fun.
So, again, we got about a minute left. What I want to be able to do is kind of give you the last thought to be able to say, you know, where you're at, where people can find you, what you got coming up in the future. So take it away.
Great. The website is jameswziskin.com. The publisher is 7th Street Books, 7th Street named after the street in Philadelphia where Edgar Allan Poe lived for some time when he was writing. 7th Street is a wonderful publisher, by the way. A lot of great authors, including Alan Eskins and Mark Pryor, who are coming up next. I'm going to be at California Crime Writers, the convention or conference on June 6th and 7th. I'll be at Thriller Fest in New York City, July 10th.
Nice, I'll meet
11th,
you there.
And that's great. I'm looking forward to it. And I'll be at VoucherCon in North Carolina in October. So it's been great.
Oh, you're making the rounds.
Yeah.
That's nice. That's good. You're
I'll
see you in Thriller Fest.
I told you.
Right.
I'm in India now, so your listeners are hearing me from India at this moment. But, I try to move around a bit.
Well, I'll tell you what, James, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. It's been fabulous to talk to you and about the series that you got going on. Now, make sure you go to Goodreads and check out that giveaway that ends May 11th. Like you said, you can't win if you don't enter. And a lot of people are already on Goodreads, so you might as well go put your name in and see if you get yourself a free book. So, Jim, thanks so much for coming on and wishing nothing but the best.
Thank you so much, Sean.
You have a good day and enjoy India. We'll see you in July.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, bye-bye.
Cheers.
So again, everybody, that is author James Ziskin. You can go to jameswziskin.com for more information on the book Stone Cold Dead. Again, it is the third in his Ellie Stone mystery series. You heard a lot of information about the series, and it's, you know, that's why we bring them on. That's why we're here, find you different authors, different things that people are writing. There's so many great books out there, so make sure you check that out. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest. His name is Alan Eskins. The book he's written is called The Life We Bury, and there's much more going on with that. So we will be right back after this.
Hello, everybody, and I'd like to talk to you about some upcoming releases that are out now. Arthur Barbara Petty delivers the first book in a new series called What Has Mother Done? The title itself suggests a riveting mystery wrapped up within a drama. Reviewers have agreed that Barbara penned a winner, so check out Amazon.com for more on What Has Mother Done by Barbara Petty. 5 gripping new mysteries await you from publisher Camel Press: Stealing the Golden Dream, Due for Discard, and Split to Splinters are just a few of the wonderful books being published by Camel Press. Check out all their titles by visiting camelpress.com. The Thriller Master is back with a sequel. Yes, David Morrell releases Inspector of the Dead, which brings back character Thomas DeQuincy. Murder as a Fine Art was the first book and was listed on several of the top lists in 2014. Now experience more of 1850s London and Inspector of the Dead. Go to davidmorrell.net for more information on these and all of his books. Kensington Kills. Well, not really, but their books sure do. And author Lisa Jackson, M. William Phelps, A.J. Tana, and more deliver explosive action and intrigue with every page. Make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information on these and every title they have to offer, and you won't be sorry. Suspense Theater comes alive with Amon Kabachnik. His Blood on the Stage books bring readers a wealth of material for lovers of the stage, says the Los Angeles Times. Check out Where Stories Come Alive and visit Amon Kabachnik for more information on all six of these titles, and that's AMNONKABATCHNIK.com. A century-old tale leads to a fortune in Bandit Gold. That's the adventure that Jack Farrell faces in his latest adventure, Murrieta Gold, by author William Nickel. This is the fourth book in the series, and visit William Nickel, that's two K's, EL.com for more information on this and the entire series.
Welcome back, everybody. After the break, we want to thank you all again for joining us, however, wherever, whenever you listen to the show. It's always a pleasure that you guys are always here and joining us. Of course, make sure you check out suspenseradionetwork.com for all the stuff we have on all the shows. We had a very exciting show that happened last night with the Story Blender. You want to make sure you checked out that. Crime and Science Radio will be coming up next Saturday. Last time they had Hank Philip P. Ryan on. That was a classic show, so make sure you get involved with that one. And the next one coming up is very in-depth detail with a lot of great stuff on CSI Forensics. We are going to hit it now with our next guest. His name is Alan Eskins. The book is called The Life We Bury. So we want to thank Alan for coming on the show. So, Alan, how are you doing?
I am doing great. How are you doing today?
You know what? Doing pretty good. Again, we want to thank you so much for coming on. And you're going to be here talking about your debut book coming out, The Life We Bury. It's a very exciting time. It's always exciting when the debut one comes out right out of the gate, kind of just starting to get involved in this crazy world of publishing. And you start thinking, I should have taken the blue pill, but you've already sucked down the red one, so now you're in it. So here you go, The Life We Bury. Let us know what you got going on with this one.
Okay, I'm actually very excited to have taken the red pill. The Life We Bury came out in October of 2014. It is my debut novel. It tells the story of a college student named Joe Talbert. Joe gets an assignment to go and interview somebody and write their story. So he goes to a nursing home looking for a subject for this assignment and meets Carl Iverson. Carl Iverson is a man who is dying of cancer. But Carl Iverson was medically paroled from prison after spending 30 years incarcerated for murder. So Joe decides he's going to do this man's story, and it is in doing Carl's story that Joe Talbert gets pulled into a 30-year-old mystery. That's the premise for the mystery part of the novel, but there's a second part of the novel that is, at least to me, as important, if not more, than the mystery part, which is Joe kind of ran away from home to go to college. And in doing so, he left behind a dysfunctional mother and his 18-year-old autistic brother. And during the course of the novel, Joe keeps getting pulled back to his hometown to deal with his mother and take care of his brother. And over the course of the novel, he has to come to terms with his decision to leave his brother behind. And the title for the novel, The Life We Bury, is a metaphor for that struggle that Joe is going through. It came out in October of last year. It's done far better than I had ever anticipated or hoped for. It came out of the chute on some like library reads list, and Amazon had it as one of their picks for October of last year. It rounded out the year with, it was on some lists for like Suspense Magazine had it as one of the best debut novels for the year. And then it's been nominated for a number of awards, so I'm very, very thrilled with how it's going.
And that's kind of great coming right out of the gate. Of course, you're not really sure what to expect when you write a book, and then all of a sudden you start going through the agent process. We're straight to the publisher either way, or you're even publishing it on your own. I mean, there's several different ways that you can do it now. But when you finally get that call that 7th Street Books wants to, you know, publish your book, and now the day's finally here that it's out and you see it and you're starting to talk about it, how is that process? Is it something that was kind of that you had to learn because you're still learning, you know, maybe how to go through interviews, how to, because, you know, we're all different. All of us, when we're going to ask you questions and doing all this stuff, we're all going to be a little different. And if anybody asks you where you get your inspiration from, like I always tell them, I say, I just sit in the bathroom and it just comes to me. So how has this experience so far been for you?
Well, I love writing, so I was going to write whether I got published or not. So when I finished my, you know, The Life We Bury, I decided early on that I was going to go through traditional publishing. So I was just going to keep writing manuscripts until I wrote one that I can get an agent with. And so I started querying The Life We Bury, and that process is frustrating. It took a long time to get an agent. But when I finally got one, I absolutely love my agent, Amy Clogley, with Kimberly Cameron Agency. She was terrific. She sent me some emails saying, you know, here's some minor changes I'd like to make in the book. We did those revisions, and then we sent it out to publishers. And from that point on, she took it and ran with it. We sent it to 8 publishers, got requests for manuscripts from 4, and then offers from 2. So within a matter of weeks of her taking over and submitting it, you know, I had a book deal. And that was truly exciting because when you're writing that debut novel, for me, I'm sitting in my basement typing and on my computer, and I have no idea if anybody's ever going to read what I'm writing. That could be just a huge, you know, frustration, but because I enjoy writing, I was going to do it regardless. But to, you know, actually have someone say, yeah, we're going to acquire your rights, we're going to publish your book, we're going to put it in bookstores and, you know, see it all over the country, get, you know, emails from all over the world. It's extremely exciting.
Yeah, I bet when you're sitting there and you see it come to life, that's always a great moment when you finally, all that hard work. How long did it take you to actually write the book and get it all done?
Well, my version of the book, you know, with the draft that I sent to my agent, took me about a year, a little over a year. There's some revisions that I did during the query process. But from start to finish, when I had a first draft I thought was good enough to go to an agent with, it was about a year. I outline voluminously. So I would outline for 3 or 4 months, and then I'd sit down and just start writing. And the writing comes fairly quickly to me once I have the outline done. So about a year from beginning to end, and then once Amy got it, she asked for some more changes, so that took another couple months. And so all told, a little over a year.
That's not bad. That's actually pretty quick. I mean, you hear a lot of people saying, you know, it took them 3, 4, 5 years to finally get their first book out, just because a lot of times you go through and then you start having people read it and then they're having to change it, and then you have your editor going through and then, you know, they're changing things, and then you start scrapping ideas. But that's good that you're able to kind of come right out and hit it. And now,
well,
when you were...
That may be a little... I may be a little misleading. I have another manuscript that I've never sent out. So over the 20 years when I was learning to write, I was practicing on that manuscript. Yeah. So for 20 years I was working on this other manuscript, just kind of, you know, playing around with it. And as I was learning how to write better and taking classes and stuff, I would incorporate that into this other manuscript. But then when the day came that I decided I was going to actually write a novel to try and get it published, I put that manuscript away and started fresh with The Life We Bury. And it was something that had been in my head for a while. So it may be a little misleading to say it just took a year, because it was something that was percolating in my head for a number of years before I sat down to write it.
Gotcha. Okay, now I gotcha. Yeah, there's always that one, isn't there? Now, and you just said percolating in your head. So was it the plot, or was it your character, Joe Talbert, that was the one that kind of brought you to the table to write this book?
I would have to say it was the character. When I was going through trying to find ideas, I wanted to find a plot that had to do, like Alfred Hitchcock, where he'd take an average person and thrust them into an extraordinary circumstance and then let them react. You know, the Man Who Knew Too Much, North by Northwest. So I thought I wanted to have that kind of story. So I started coming up with ideas, you know, who would my protagonist be that would be thrust into this unique world. And I remembered I did this assignment when I was in college. I went out to a nursing home to just interview some random person. And I thought, what would happen if that person had this dark secret? And so I started with Joe being a college student. And I knew that I would also have Joe running away from home for some reason. And so I focused on Joe, you know, and this assignment, and you know, why did he run away from home? And that was the nexus or the genesis for the story.
Gotcha. Okay. Did I lose you?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. I thought I heard a click. So give us a little background here into Joe. Like, what kind of person is he? Who is he? What you know? Why was he the one that you felt would be the perfect one to basically be the star of your debut novel?
Well, I come from a blue-collar background. I'm the first one of my siblings to go to college, and so I thought there's something about that I liked. So I wanted to have Joe come from a blue-collar town, a blue-collar background, and I wanted him to want to go to college to try and, you know, have his own life away from his mother and his brother. So I gave him a job as a bouncer at a bar. That will give him a tougher edge than normal. But I think Joe's main strength is ingenuity. He gets into some scrapes, and it is through his, you know, creative thinking that he gets out of them. One reviewer called him a super sleuth. I would not consider him a super sleuth. He's more a guy who kind of bumbles through, and the people around him are the ones who contribute more intelligence. Joe's main skill is surviving and having the ingenuity to and the creativity to get through the dangerous scrapes he gets into. So I like the character. He's an underdog. He is, you know, trying to change the course of his path by going to college, and he's barely able to afford college. He's got this younger brother that needs him, and just a whole complexity of all the problems that he's struggling with during the course of this novel, where he's also, you know, looking into this 30-year-old mystery.
Yeah, and you have it set, you know, and he is a college student now. I guess the question, you know, why would you want it? Why that young? Like why go back like that young?
That young?
Yeah, like, you know, like why college? Was there a reason why college? Is there a specific reason why you picked that?
Well, that is probably when I was personally at my poorest. You know, working full time to go through college, and so I understood that struggle. You know, now I have a law practice, and, you know, life is pretty comfortable, but I wanted to tell a story of someone who was not comfortable. And I remembered, you know, the struggles that I was going through when I was in college to try and, you know, keep going to college. That was part of it. Also, the assignment itself that I did, being that, you know, I thought that was a wonderful way to step into a mystery. You know, just have somebody that you meet at a nursing home decide you're going to be his confessor. And that pulls you in. So that was the reason. I wasn't planning on doing a series, so it didn't matter that my protagonist wasn't a cop or a reporter or a medical examiner. I was just planning to do this one book and see how it did. So why not use a college student?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. You know, a lot of authors, of course, out there, when they start thinking college student, they're like, oh, is this going to be, you know, am I going to turn this into like a YA or whatever? I mean, they don't really think the fact that college, you know, you're still adult. And a lot of them, of course, go more of the adult range and, you know, the 30, 40, 50-year-old person and struggles and this and that. I think it's very admirable. It could be difficult to try to capture that. And so what were your struggles when you were writing the book, The Life We Bury?
Well, I think if I had an editor looking over my shoulder, he would have, or she would have told me not to write this story because it has, you know, issues with regard to, you know, it's going to be hard to create a series out of this. You're dealing with a character who is not, he doesn't have the professional background to solve mysteries. So I had to incorporate that level of intelligence into the novel. So, for example, I have Joe go to the police and ask for their assistance, but because he's looking into a murder that has already been solved as far as they're concerned, you know, this guy was tried and convicted by a jury of his peers, they're not really interested in reopening the case. But he does get guidance from the homicide detective he goes to. He also goes to a law professor with the Innocence Project with this, and that law professor helps him out. So I put in secondary characters that would, in a normal novel, be more of the protagonist of their own story, because they have the expertise and experience to help him in his journey. I also give him a female character that he has a, you know, an affection for, to be kind of his, you know, intelligence. She's smarter than he is in terms of looking at things and solving puzzles. So I have people around him who give him the help that he needs, where if he were a 30-year-old person, I would actually put those characteristics within my protagonist himself.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, that's perfect, you know, when you're going through and you're, and I love secondary characters, and because those are the ones I think that make the book. I think it's the secondary characters that are the ones that bring everything together. They're the ones that, that pull all the story together. Because really, without them, you're just going to have a guy walking around and, you know, and it's just not very interesting. So which secondary character do you feel had a bigger voice than you thought they would when you finished? Which one surprised you?
Max Rupert. He's the homicide detective. I inserted him more than I expected to when I first started writing the novel, although, like I said, I outlined, so I knew pretty much his role. But by the time I finished writing The Life We Bury, I went back and rewrote Max's character a little bit because I decided that my next book was going to be Max's story. So I have three more books coming out that are going to be a three-book arc for Max Rupert. And so rather than have a series with, you know, Joel Talbert, I'm going to take these secondary characters and create stories for them. So I have three books coming out with Max, and then Bodhi Sandin, who's the law professor, I've got a story in mind for him after that. And then at that point, Joe's going to be graduated from college, and he's going to be a reporter because he's a journalism student now. So I can come back to Joe because there's some family issues that I want to readdress with Joe in a later book. So I will someday come back to Joe, but not for a few books.
And so that's, I mean, that's an interesting path where you decide to kind of right off the bat after the first book, take that secondary character and move them out. I mean, a lot of people have done it that way, but boy, you said he did it kind of fast. You must really like got into him and been like, all right, I got to just keep exploring what's going on with this guy.
Well, I knew that I wasn't going to have Joe do another mystery just because I'm not a big fan of the amateur sleuth who keeps stumbling over bodies. Like, you know, a college student, how am I going to get Joe to find another mystery to solve when he's in college? For my own personal taste, that wasn't what I wanted to do. So when I finished with The Life We Bury and I got a publisher, then my agent starts talking about, well, book number two. And I like the character of Max Rupert. I had a idea for how the arc would go over three books in terms of this underlying thread. And I presented that to my publisher, and they liked the idea. So it just kind of spawned itself, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, I mean, I'm a fan of Tana French. I'm a fan of, Michael Connelly does this with his Holler and Bosch characters. And I like that idea of having a community that you come back to. So as your reader is reading book three and you bring a character from book one into a chapter, they go, oh, I remember that person. You know, they were in book one. Here's, you know, and they remember that role. So it creates a community, not just one person going through the world, you know, solving crimes by themselves.
Right. I mean, it's more of a community. It's definitely more of a several characters than just one. Even though, of course, you know, you got kind of one driving the things behind. I let me remind everybody here real quick, though. Your website is alleneskens.com. That's alleneskens.com. The book is The Life We Bury. It's available now. So you can get it wherever books are sold, however you normally buy them. They're all out there. Okay, so let's kind of talk a little bit about when the book came out and you started getting reviews in. What was that like for you as a brand new author? I mean, how scared were you? Let's face it.
How scared?
Yeah, I mean, were you worried, like, oh my God, now it's out there, now people are actually going to start reading it and reviewing it. What are they going to think of it? Were you worried?
Yeah, like, I don't think you cannot be. You think, well, I think I wrote a good book, but I have no idea what other people are going to think of it. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to go traditional, because I wanted to have other people say, you know, I think your book is good, and, you know, and give that validation to me. So then the reviews started coming in, and the first thing that came in wasn't even a review. It was they took my book to Book Expo America last May, and one of my fellow authors, I think it was Mark Pryor, who's going to be on today. He emailed me and said that people were picking up my book a lot at BEA, and that was the first sense of encouragement that at least the cover was good. Then I started getting the reviews coming in, and by midsummer, I was really excited about the launch coming in October, and things just kept getting better and better.
Yeah. So you're having fun with this experience. Not everybody has fun in this experience, I got to tell you. There's a lot of mean people out there.
I just went to New York City last week for the Edgar Awards. I was a finalist for best debut at the Edgars.
Oh, nice.
So here I am in a room with, you know, some of my heroes, including Stephen King, and, you know, drinking champagne. It was just surreal almost. So,
you mean Stephen was actually there?
Yeah. Stephen was there.
Wow.
It was just a wonderful experience.
Huh. Yeah, you know what? He ain't always there. It's kind of tough to nail him down sometimes.
Well, it's good that he was there because he won in his category, so that was nice.
I wonder if they told him ahead of time, Stephen, you're going to win, so please show up.
I don't know. They didn't. I don't know.
Yeah. So, was that more like your first experience of kind of being around a lot of authors and in that kind of realm? Because it can be very intimidating the first time you kind of do that.
Well, my first experience was I went to BoucherCon in November of 2014, just a couple weeks after my book came out, and I'd be standing there and you know, somebody would point to an author and say that, you know, that's so and so, and I would know the name, but I would not know the faces because I don't normally, you know, attach author faces necessarily to their names. And so you'd be walking around and, you know, meet people. I was at the Minnesota Book Awards a couple weeks ago, and a friend of mine, an author, came up to me, and we were talking, and I look at the woman she's with, and it's Judith Guest, who wrote Ordinary People. And it's like, I just started fanboying all over the place. It's really a great time.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, are you going... What other place are you going to this year? Are you going to be at Thriller Fest? Are you going to go any place else?
I'm going to Thriller Fest. I'm, you know, very pleased to be a finalist for Best First Novel there. I'm going to BoucherCon in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm a finalist for the Barry Award there. I don't have any plans beyond BoucherCon right now, but I'm sure more stuff will come up, you know, as the year goes on.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be at Book Expo America also.
Okay. Yeah. I've never been to that one. I don't know. I guess a lot of people say, oh, a lot of people go there and this and that. But, yeah, I mean, we go to a lot of, you know, different things. And I think that the events are great. And I think when you start mingling, you start seeing, you also start talking to different authors about ideas and writing, and you start incorporating some of that stuff in there. So Have you received some kind of piece of advice moving forward with your career?
I've received a lot of encouragement, and that's really nice to have authors who I know and respect come and say, you know, I read your novel, I really loved it. You know, that is, you know, a wonderful compliment. These are people who they could see me and brush by me and not say a word to me if they chose to, but they, you know, they go out of their way to let me know that they like my work, and it's I cannot tell you how wonderful this year has been. It's just been terrific.
Yeah, that's good, and that makes for a positive experience. Like I said, you know, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of non-positive experience out there, and I feel that that's, you know, that that's kind of bad, but that's good that you're able to kind of, you know, get that positive experience and things moving forward, because we need to see a lot more writers.
I agree. I do know some people who are frustrated by the process, especially the marketing aspect of books. And
oh, yeah, it's a toughie.
Yeah, I've been fortunate that I don't have to, you know, go out and self-market. I do self-market, like, you know, I'm doing this radio show. I love doing this stuff. But there are friends of mine who self-marketing is their only source of getting the word out, and that's just a full-time job in and of itself.
Right. It is. I mean, it's definitely a difficult one to have to go out there and do it. But I'll tell you what, we got about less than a minute left. What I want you to do is tell everybody, again, what you got going on in the future, where they can find you, the whole nine yards. It's all you
know. My next novel will be out on October 6th of this year. It's called The Guise of Another. Like I said, it's Max Rupert's, the first story in a three-book Max Rupert series. It is available now on pre-order. The Life We Bury is available all over the place. It's going to be coming out in Target stores in July. So it's getting a bit ubiquitous. And hopefully The Guise of Another allows me to take the next step in this process. It's, you know, I'm looking forward to its launch.
Yeah. Well, keep writing, my man. Keep writing. That's
oh, my, I absolutely will.
Yeah. Well, hey, it was a pleasure to talk to you, Alan. I really appreciate it. Good luck with the book. Can't wait to see what you got coming up in the future. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.
So, again, everybody, that is author Alan Eskens. That's Alan, ESKENS.com. The book is The Life We Bury. Hey, finalist for the Edgar Awards. You just heard it right there. So make sure you go out there and start checking out a new author, brand new book, debut book. So get your butt up out of the seat, go buy them wherever they're sold. Amazon, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever you buy books, you'll find it. We're going to take another short break. We're going to be back here with our last guest of the show. His name is Mark Pryor. Got a couple things coming up, and a couple books that he has out. Got a lot of stuff going on when I started looking around. So we are going to be right back right after this.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Reichs, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlene Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
Thank you. Night of sin, the shaking, the tremble of Night of sin, it's all inside.
So welcome back, everybody, here. We are on our last segment of our show today. We want to thank our other guests for being on, James Diskin and, of course, Alan Eskins, who was just on. Again, make sure you check out SuspenseRadioNetwork.com for all the shows and everything that we have going on. Our website is updated with our latest guests, and that's the best place to find out all the shows that we got going on. We got some other things that are happening, too. So here we go. We are going to hit it with our next author. He is named Mark Pryor. He has a lot of things out here right now. The first one that he has out is his latest book. It's called The Button Man. It is book four in his Hugo Marston series coming out in June. Then he has another book coming out later this year. So we got to figure out what he's doing, because we're happy that he's able to take some time away from his computer from all the writing that he's been doing lately to speak with us. So, Mark, we want to thank you for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're probably not used to talking a lot because you're around the computer typing so much because of all the books that you got, you know, you rolling out here. But let's get right into the latest one that's out right now. Like we said, it's book four. It's in your Hugo Marston series. It's called The Button Man. So let's jump into that one right now, and then we'll kind of dance around and see what else you got going on.
It's number four in the series. My protagonist is... It's Hugo Marston, as you said, head of security at the U.S. Embassy in Paris. Although, even though it's book four, this is actually a prequel. So it takes him back to the beginning of his career as an RSO at the embassy and has him in London.
And now, for people who aren't really familiar, of course, with the character and the series and everything else, and now that you're in book four and book five comes out in June, why don't you give a rundown of everything about, you know, Hugo Marston and the series in general, so people now have a good understanding about what is going forward?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. Thank you. Hugo is, I always think of him as kind of an old-fashioned hero. He describes himself actually as a watcher, not a player. He's originally from Austin, Texas, which is where I live now. But he is a former FBI agent. He was in the profiling unit for the FBI before he got hired by the State Department to be head of security at the U.S. Embassy in London. He uses his profiling skills, obviously, to solve various crimes that crop up. He has a friend named Tom, who's sort of a buddy. They play the buddy role with some of these mysteries. Tom's not in all of the books. But Tom is the foul mouth. He's kind of the counterpoint to Hugo. He swears and drinks and chases women, whereas Hugo sort of acts a little bit like his big brother and sometimes even his dad, trying to rein him in. So the original, the first book actually takes place by the banks of the River Seine in Paris. And the first novel is called The Bookseller. I don't know if you've been to Paris, but they have these wonderful... Okay, they have these great stalls right alongside the river. They're basically big metal trays that these booksellers called bouquinistes, they come by every morning, they just unlock these huge trays, open them up, and you have a ready-to-go bookstall.
Wow.
And it's pretty neat. It's very unique to Paris. And they sell postcards and tourist trinkets and books. So... the story centers around one of these guys, one of these bouquinistes, and his name is Max. He's a friend of Hugo's because one of Hugo's passions is collecting books. So they've struck up a friendship. And one day Hugo's buying a book from Max, and he's kidnapped right in front of Hugo's eyes, and there's nothing he can do about it. Obviously, it's his friend, and he feels bad that this guy was kidnapped without him stopping it. So Hugo launches his own investigation into what happened. And that necessarily entails kind of investigating his friend Max. And he makes some unusual discoveries. He finds out that Max was a former Nazi hunter and probably has some enemies from having done that. He wonders whether maybe the books that he was selling had something to do with his kidnapping. And then the stakes kind of ratchet up a little bit when another bookseller and then another one go missing. So that's Hugo's job to try and figure out what's going on in that one. And the second one is called The Crypt Thief. And what I'm trying to do with each book is sort of focus on a little bit of a part of Paris. So the book in East is the bookseller, revolves around a couple of that city's beautiful, beautiful cemeteries. And it starts off with, the Crypt Thief starts with an American couple being murdered in Père Lachaise, which is the biggest and most famous of the Paris cemeteries. But nobody can figure out how this guy's getting in and out of the cemetery. They've got cameras and walls and guards, and still this guy's coming and going. So because one of them's an American who's killed, Hugo is called in to help with the investigation. and then the third one is called The Blood Promise. And that one involves an old chest that is discovered to have a secret letter in it. This one's one of the hardest books to talk about without giving anything away. But suffice it to say that it's a letter, 200-year-old letter that reveals a secret that somebody's trying very hard to cover up. And then after that one is The Button Man, which is the sort of the current one, and that's when I take a step back in time and put Hugo back in London.
Nice. So he's kind of been around the gamut now. You know, Hugo's kind of like you said, he's kind of been around a little bit of the gamut, seeing a lot of things. And I like the fact that not everything has to be a murder, does it?
No, I don't think it does. I think what people like to see is a hero who's faced with a mystery. And I don't think it has to be a murder. I think it can be a kidnapping. I think it could be an old letter that has some meaning that somebody has to figure out. It doesn't, you know. Like Hugo, I think my book's a little bit old-fashioned. There aren't a lot of car chases and gunfights, and they sort of waver on that thriller mystery line, and just a little bit old-fashioned. You know, like I said, Hugo wears his cowboy boots, but he also wears a hat and a long coat. And I try to make the books as much about the places that they're set in, sort of atmospheric. I'm a big fan of Alan Thirst, who does a fantastic job of portraying, you know, Europe's cities back in the late 30s, before the war. I'm a big fan of his, and I feel like I've learned a lot about making a city or a place part of a city, sort of a character in the book.
Yeah, and that's the hard part that I feel a lot of authors struggle with, is the setting. Sometimes the setting kind of gets lost within the story. It's like they set it up at the beginning, and then it just kind of falls apart at the end. So you're cautiously kind of thinking about that, like you said, as a character on its own, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, wherever a murder takes place, a setting doesn't have to be part of the story, but for me it is. And part of that, I think, is because Hugo is essentially, he's a fish out of water. And, you know, he's a Texan wearing cowboy boots on the streets of Paris. And so I think it's sort of necessary to remind him, and therefore the reader, that he's not playing at home. He's in a foreign country. He's dealing with a police force that sometimes looks at him as a bit of a Butinsky. and also, you know, the other side of that is that the reason he's there is that he loves to travel. He loves learning new things, meeting new people. And so if he in a quiet moment takes a walk down a side street and discovers a new restaurant, I think that's fun for him to do, and it's fun for me to write, and hopefully it's fun for the reader to discover part of a new city too.
Yeah, I always thought that's always interesting, because like you said, I've never been to Paris, but if I can walk through the streets through a book, it almost kind of makes me feel like I've been there, and it kind of gets me the itch to maybe want to go see it for myself. And so I do love when I read these kinds of books set in places that I've never been, to be able to see that. And of course, there's thousands of books set in Paris, but when you kind of see the seedy side of things, I really get intrigued by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real... Yeah. Travel is expensive these days, I know that.
Sure.
And so if you can take a bit of a vacation in the pages of a book. In fact, I have a friend who's married, and he bought the bookseller for his wife, and he came up to me afterwards, and, you know, sometime afterwards, and said he was kind of mad at me because now his wife was insisting that he take her to Paris, and you know, he didn't want to spend the money, he didn't want to go. And then 6 weeks later, he comes up to me again, big grin on his face, and he says, "Oh man, I love Paris. We love it. We're going to do everything we can to move there. Thank you so much." So that made me very happy.
But you know, you also have, you know, I mean, Hugo's not the only person that, you know, that you kind of write about, because you have coming up, what was it, October? It's a book called The Hollow Man, or September. My fault, September.
Yeah.
Is this a complete standalone? Is this something that's totally different outside the realm of the Hugo series?
It's actually something totally different. Yeah, it's a standalone. It's the book is set here in Austin, and it's a lot darker and a lot creepier. In fact, when my wife is the first reader of my books, and I gave her the book to read, and we were sitting in bed. I was reading it, and she was reading that. And I was reading something else, and she kept looking across at me. And eventually, I was like, "What? What are you looking at?" And she takes a second and she goes, "Do I need to worry about you?" So,
Was this a book that you had with you for a while, or was this just the fact that you just wanted to kind of separate yourself from the Hugo character for a second and write something different?
I did want to do that, but I didn't want to force anything. And I had a couple of incidents, sort of real life things that happened that I just tucked away in the back of my mind.
Sure.
One of them was, I don't know if you know, but I'm in real life, I'm a prosecutor. And so, you know, I have that,
I have that
avenue. Yeah, I am. And I was working, on one of our drug court, where if somebody's had picked up a case with drugs, we try and get them treatment instead of prison and what have you, but they have to come to court every now and again. And then one day I was sitting there and they brought this pale, thin girl in her jumps in the prison garb in handcuffs, and she was a heroin addict, and she said she wanted to join the drug court program. She wanted to get clean. She wanted to change her life, and I didn't really pay much attention to her, but she showed up again the next week, and this pale, thin waif had turned into this absolute stunning. You have to understand that most people who show up there show up in shorts and t-shirts and flip flops and perhaps don't shave for a few days. This girl swan through the court in a lime green dress, bright red shoes, just stunning. She looked like a 1950s actress, and just everybody was totally taken with her. And then she disappeared. She just totally disappeared. And I've always wondered what happened to her, but that image of her has always stuck in my mind. And I wanted to use it in a book, and so I was able to do with Hollow Man. But that was just sort of rattling around inside my head until a friend told me another story, a true story that happened here in Austin about a guy who came up from Honduras, I think, and bought a trailer in a trailer park and fixed it up and then rented it out. And then with the money from that, he bought another one, fixed that up and rented it out. And he just kept going and going. And at the end of each month, he would drive around in his van. He would collect the rent money in cash. Which is, you know, reasonable thing to do when you've got 2, 3, 4, 5 of these. But this guy ended up with over 100 trailers. And so he would,
wow.
But he would still do it. And he would still drive around in his van, picking up cash from all these renters. So this guy was driving around dodgy parts of Austin, tens of thousands of dollars in the back of his van. And when my friend told me that story, I just thought, whoa, that's something. Somebody has to do something with that. A simple theft of a van with tens of thousands—that's too good to leave alone. So, once I heard that story, that really pushed me into writing Hollow Man.
Did you find it at any time like, please stop getting into my head so I can literally go on and do something else? Or were you just like, okay, I hear you. I'm just going to write it. I'm writing it now. Okay, leave me alone.
Yeah, I mean, at any one time, I have, you know, I have 3 or 4 ideas bouncing around inside. And I can be writing. Yesterday, I started writing Hugo number 6. But I also had a notebook next to me that I have thoughts for another standalone. Again, one that's, for some reason, I suppose, naturally, perhaps set here in Texas. I'll be writing one book and then having thoughts on another and scribbling them down. And at some point I'll probably switch that process. I sometimes wonder if I should see a psychiatrist. It's too much of a compulsion.
And now when people see you for the first time, and you're, maybe you're talking about the Buttman, or maybe you're talking about, you know, other books in your series, and they say, hey, you know what, I've never heard of you. Where is a good place for them to maybe start to figure out who the author Mark Pryor is? Where do you kind of lead them first?
Well, I mean, I point people to my website, and that sort of has the basics about me and the books, and that's markpryorbooks.com. But, you know, to learn a little bit more about me, I have had a blog running for, gosh, it must be 7 or 8 years now. And I think I'm right in saying that it was one of the first ever blogs run by a prosecutor. So
nice.
If you go, it's called DA Confidential. And if people go right to the beginning of that, I talk a lot about my job, the kinds of cases that I handle. And then it sort of morphs a little bit into the book world, in interviews with authors, my own, you know, the videos I've made of my book trailers, stuff like that. So a lot of posts to look through, but that's really, mm-hmm. you know, if someone wants to learn a little bit about me, DA Confidential is probably the best place to go to.
And so you don't have like one book maybe that you kind of say, this is a good place to start reading my work?
You know, I always point people to the bookseller. It was, and I don't know whether that's because it was my first, and, you know, we're not allowed to have favorites among our books. But I think the bookseller is a great place to start. It's you know, it introduces Hugo, and it says a little bit more about his friendship with Tom. It's the first place he meets Claudia, his on again, off again, love interest. And I think maybe it's perhaps the most atmospheric, perhaps, mm-hmm. of the books about Paris. And, you know, it's funny because each book is slightly different, I think, like The Crypt Thief, and maybe because it's set in the cemeteries. If people tell me they like slightly more thriller-esque and darker books, then I might point them towards The Crypt Thief because that's a little creepier. Yeah, well, you know, you've got somebody who's murdering people in graveyards. That's about as creepy as it gets.
Is that funny when you sit there and you start talking to people and you literally sit there and then that's what you say is, you know, that's a little creepy. Yeah, he's killing people in cemeteries. And they just look at you like, what did you just say?
Well, but that's the thing. Usually if people are talking to me about it, that's the kind of thing they love. And
oh, yeah. We're
crazy,
aren't we?
They're super excited
aren't
about
crazy?
It.
Yeah. I tell you. I mean, humans are crazy.
I like that. I do this thing now because I'm writing so many books. I used to have a hard time coming up with character names. So when I give a talk or do a book launch, I will quite literally pass around a hat. And if anybody wants the name to be a character, they can drop their little piece of paper with their name and email in the hat. And then if I need a name, I'll pick it out of the hat and they're a character. But I did that at a library function here in Austin. And there must have been between 80 and 100 people, mostly you know, older ladies in their 50s, 60s, 70s, even 80s. And so I said, hey, guys, I'm going to do this. And everyone got very excited. And I said, well, hang on a second. I need to tell you the next book is set in Paris and I'm afraid I'm going to need some dead prostitutes. And I must say about 80% of the people put up their hand saying, I want to be a dead prostitute. I want to be a dead prostitute. And it was classic. right then and there, I knew I was with my people.
Yeah. I mean, you've been out in several book signings and you've done several events and things like that. Is there one besides this one that maybe sticks out where you had an experience where you were even creeped out?
Do you mean an event?
Yeah, any kind of event, maybe a book signing, or did somebody come up to you that you were just like, wow, this person kind of creeps me out a little bit.
You know, that happens occasionally. In the third book, I try to have not just Hugo, but probably four or five major characters that the reader can really get to know. I don't want to be too much centered on one person. And in the third book, I kill one of those people off. And I had been corresponding by email with a nice woman who'd emailed me after the book sale and how much she loved it and couldn't wait to read The Crypt Thief. And she emailed me again after The Crypt Thief and couldn't wait to read The Blood Promise. And then she emailed me after The Blood Promise and said, "What the hell did you do that for?" And, you know, it's a fair question because a lot of people got upset. And so I wrote back a very long, and she was genuinely upset. She was genuinely mad. And so I thought, well, I'm going to take the time to write to her and explain why I think it was a good idea or even necessary. Never heard from her again. That was that, because I'd killed off the character. And then about 2 weeks later, I was at Murder by the Book in Houston, and a woman came up to me right before the event, and she said, "I just want to ask you about why you killed X." And I thought, oh, gosh, I hope it's not the same person, because I know she's very angry. And it turned out to be somebody who, once I explained, she was like, "Oh, okay, I see. I'm sad, but I see why you did that." But we have, yeah,
well,
clearly we have
good.
People
at least
who are
very... At least she seemed, you know, understanding.
Yeah, and you know, I on the one hand, it's super flattering that somebody would get that worked up over a character I created. That's very, very flattering. But on the other hand, the person is imaginary. I mean, nobody actually
died.
Right.
And that's the thing.
I don't know.
But here's the other thing, of course, and you've been doing this quite some time. Never kill an animal.
I have not done that yet. And I think children and animals are I gather they are out of bounds and not to be touched.
And that's one thing I was going to ask because, you know, like you mentioned, I mean, somebody going into the cemetery and doing all that they're doing, you know, you need dead hookers and things like that. Is there a subject that you literally just won't get involved in, that you won't touch just because it's just too much?
Yeah, actually there is. I'm thinking hard in case I'm going to tell a lie, but I don't think that I have... written about rape. I don't think I've included rape in any of my books. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that I think sometimes it's used too lightly to portray that the bad guy is a bad guy. And the real ramifications of rape are not portrayed. And the person who's being raped isn't portrayed as a real character. So that makes me uncomfortable. And also, I think it's also partly because of my job. You know, I've handled those kinds of cases, and there's just something about the people who do it and the effect it has on the victim that I just I think I prefer, you know, this, if I can kill lots of other people instead, I'll just go ahead and do that.
Yeah, and do you use your practice, a lot of the things, do you bring them into your stories? I mean, whether indirectly or directly, but just change the names to help the people out?
You know, I haven't really used any of the incidents, like any of the actual crimes that I've prosecuted. And to be honest, a lot of the reasons for that is that a lot of the crime that we deal with is kind of grubby and not very interesting. It's not sexy murders. But what I do use and have found to be a huge asset is my knowledge of how an investigation works, or a prosecution, how it all fits together, who does what, why they do it, in what order they do it. And I have a very large contact list in my phone of people I can get hold of, you know, like a medical examiner. If I want to poison somebody, I can find out whether a particular poison would be detected, or if I have, you know, how long would it take to, I did this Hollow Man. I called a friend of mine who works for Austin Police, and I said, you know, if you find a gun, how quickly can you identify the owner of that gun? Because
sure.
I don't know that. And so I'm lucky in my position as a prosecutor to have access to these folks. Although, you know, my understanding and from talking to other authors is that if, you know, you're a writer and you want some information and you just randomly call a police officer or a medical examiner or a detective, they're always extremely helpful. I know my people are always very, very keen to help. But I think generally cops love the idea of helping an author put together a murder.
Yeah, that's why we have the show that we do on Suspense Radio Network, which is Crime and Science Radio, which is done by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. And Doug Lyle, you might know, he's the guy who wrote Forensics for Dummy, More Forensics and
yeah.
More, and all these books. And it's because all the guests they bring on are CSI, they're forensic, they're FBI, they're CIA, they're people that have been in there, and they let you know how it really is in real life. You know, you can't find DNA results in a day. It doesn't happen that
yeah.
way. You know?
No, it does not. And,
it takes some time.
And that's fabulous that you do that. And it's great that you do that because the science is changing all of the time.
All the time.
A book that was great 5-10 years ago will be out of date now. So it's fantastic that you guys are doing that and just continually updating the science for us. It's really helpful.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and we have hours and hours of footage with just all these people. I mean, from investigative reporters to, of course, you know, Linda Fairstein, who basically her work is why there's Law and Order Special Victims Unit in New York.
Right.
So, yeah, all these things so that, you know, so people can kind of understand the behind-the-scenes thing. But I'll tell you what, Mark, we're already out of time. I cannot believe it. I'm just sitting here just enthralled in the conversation. It's been so wonderful to have you on. But I want to give you the last kind of minute so you can kind of let everybody know, you know, what you have going out, where they can find you, and the whole nine yards. So take it away.
Yeah, sure. Obviously, the current book is The Button Man. That's on sale in all the bookstores, online, all its various e-forms. Then a reminder that I think it's June 3rd, The Reluctant Matador comes out, which is the next Hugo book, and that's set in Barcelona, which is a very, very cool city. September the 1st is Hollow Man, and I'm real excited about that book. It's a departure for me, and my editor and agent are very, very excited about it. Anybody's welcome to email me with comments or questions. My contact form is on the website, which is markpryorbooks.com, or check me out at DA Confidential. And thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, Mark, it has been such a pleasure. I mean, you're welcome back anytime you want to come on, because we can continue this discussion for a very long time. So thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. You have a good one and enjoy.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Mark Pryor, and you want to make sure you check him out at markpryorbooks.com. Like you said, he's The Button Man is out right now in his book 4 in the Hugo Marston series. He's got book 5 coming out. He has another book standalone coming out later this year in September. So make sure that you are not missing anything that he has going on. Fantastic author. Just listen to the conversation. You know that the books are just going to be set in and just enthrall you. We want to thank all of our guests for coming on today. Of course, we had on earlier, James Ziskin was on talking about Stone Cold Dead, and then Alan Eskins, The Life We Bury. Make sure that you check out all their information. You can always go to suspenseradionetwork.com to hear more about all the shows, Crime and Science Radio, The Story Blender, Beyond the Cover, everything that we got going on, we're having you covered. We are also going to have some new information about maybe another show that we're bringing to you, and this is where the books are going to come alive. You might actually hear like the old-time suspense kind of stories listening to live here on the radio, so that's going to be a real cool thing. So we want to thank you all, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks with another Suspense Radio Inside Edition. Until then, enjoy and keep on reading.